go and show yourselves to the priests. And as they went, they were made clean. Then one of them, when he saw that he was healed, turned back, praising God with a loud voice. He prostrated himself at Jesus' feet and thanked him, and he was a Samaritan. Then Jesus asked, "Were not 10 made clean, but the other 9, where are they? Was none of them found to return and give praise to God except this foreigner?" Then Jesus said to him, "Get up and go on your way. Your faith has made you well." The Gospel of the Lord. The house in which my family lives now is the third house that we have owned, or we have borrowed from the bank to use while we are there. And there's a difference between this third house and the first two. The first two houses were brand new constructions. They were the spec homes for the developments in which we lived. And we picked them primarily because they were move-in ready. We didn't have to wait for someone to move out. We didn't have to wait for any repairs to be done. They were move-in ready. We discovered also that one of the benefits of buying a new construction is that for about the first 10 years, you don't have to make many major repairs to the house because it's still new. We didn't live in either house for long enough to see any major problems, so we never had to make any major repairs. The house in which we live now was a 1980s construction. And it seems like all we've done since 2010 is make repairs to the house. You know, our goal is to get to the aesthetic stuff, like painting the walls and getting rid of some old wallpaper and replacing the carpet and all those fun things. However, every time we are about ready to make that investment, something goes wrong with one of the systems of the house. So the water heater dies, and then the water softener dies, and then the heating and air conditioning system dies, and then the roof needs to be replaced, and then we discover that some of the windows are starting to leak, so we have to replace the windows, which is the next big investment in the house. And it's at those times when we keep investing in repairs that we think, did we make a mistake buying an older house? Because what happens is that we end up comparing the first two houses, which had a little work involved in making them the ideal houses, comparing those first two houses with the current house that needs a lot of work, the real house in which we live. And it's a lot nicer to think about the houses that didn't require any work. And because of that, we start second-guessing ourselves and wondering whether we really made the right choice. It's that difference between the ideal and the real, that perfect image of what something should be and the real image of what it's really like. Our dream in life is that the ideal and the real will be really close together, and that the way things are is the way we want them to be. It doesn't happen that way most of the time in our ordinary lives. The feeling that comes out of that disparity between ideal and real is the feeling of shame. I've done something wrong. I'm not doing something right, and that's why I can't make the two match up. Shame increases with the greater gap between the ideal and the real. And shame can become a powerful motivation for how we go about our daily lives. So I want you to listen to these 10 commandments of shame. That is, as we live a shame-driven life, let's look at the 10 commandments that we live by when we live under the power of shame. The first commandment of the power of shame is that thou shalt never think that you have enough. It's always about deficit. It's always about scarcity. It's never having everything that you want. The second commandment is thou shalt get as much attention as possible. And it doesn't matter what kind of attention, as long as it's attention. The third commandment of shame is let's find the quick fix, the one thing that will instantly solve every problem. The next commandment comes out of the first commandment, which is let's find the expert who has the quick fix so that that expert can make it happen. If the expert can't make it happen, it's also good because you have someone to blame because the expert didn't turn out to be the expert you wanted the person to be. The fifth commandment is thou shalt never show the benefit of the doubt to someone else. Assume that their motivations are always wrong and harmful. The sixth commandment is thou shalt see a person as either all good or all bad. And so even if a person makes a mistake, we assume then that person is completely bad because of one mistake, not allowing room for a person to make a mistake and still be a good person. Seventh commandment is let's be hypercritical, ever vigilant to what is wrong and continue to point that out, because the best way for me to hide from my shame is to point out what other people are doing wrong. The eighth commandment is recreationism, not recreationism, but recreationism, which is let's go back to a point when everything was perfect and recreate that moment so that everything is perfect again. And the word again is key to that commandment. The ninth commandment is that there shall not be creativity or imagination, because creativity and imagination is threatening, it's new, it's not proved, it runs the risk of failure. We don't know what to do with it, and we don't want failure, so no creativity and no imagination. And the final commandment, the tenth commandment, is that we shall always defend the dysfunctional behavior. Always defend that which is disruptive instead of that which is helpful. These Ten Commandments of Shame play out in every relationship we have. They play out in our marriage relationships. They play out in our friendships. They play out in workplace environments and neighborhood environments. And notice what happens in this letter of Paul to Timothy, the second lesson. We realize that they even play out in churches. And Paul admonishes Timothy and Timothy's church and said, "You are workers who have no need to be ashamed." No need to be ashamed. The marker of the church that shame is not what needs to drive us, but something new and something different is at the heart of the work of the church. So, the statistics are that in Boston, when the sale of ice cream increases, so do the number of drowning deaths. Now, being a culture of shame, one of the things we always want to do is we want to lay blame. So whose fault is it then that people are drowning as they eat more ice cream? Is it Turkey Hill's fault that there's something in that ice cream that causes the muscles to freeze up and one can't swim? You know, is it that we don't follow the rule that you shouldn't eat for an hour or you shouldn't swim for an hour after you eat, and then it was down to 20 minutes and now they say you don't have to worry about that rule anymore? But I've been in pools where kids have revisited what they had just eaten 5 minutes ago, so I'm not sure that rule makes a lot of sense. So is it that we aren't following that rule? You know, what is it that leads people to drown because they're eating more ice cream? Well, maybe it has nothing to do with the fact that ice cream is causing drowning. But because we need someone or something to blame, that's the first step we make in our logic. So let me ask you this question. What time of year does the sale of ice cream increase? Summer. What time of year do people swim more? Summer. Aha! So it's because it's summer that more ice cream is selling, and also that people are swimming more, which increases the risk of drowning deaths. But notice what we do is that we want to blame instead of getting the facts. So the church no longer needs to be ashamed. And if the church no longer needs to be ashamed, then perhaps it also doesn't need to blame. We are very much aware that this congregation's numbers are different now than they were 10 to 15 years ago. That we have shifted from about 900 people a week in worship to holding steady at 325 a week in worship. And what we want to do is we want to start laying blame. And if I ask each one of you, you would be able to tell me whose fault it is that we have seen that decline. And I dare say that in many of the conversations, it will be my fault that it has happened. But what I want to propose to you is that what had once been a virtuous cycle, which had kept congregations strong, that cycle has been interrupted and no longer works anymore. The cycle is based on the values of the 1950s through the 1970s, which believed that people would engage every conversation with reason, that there was optimism, that things were going to turn out okay, and so we also believed in the possibility of progress as things moved forward. We believed in self-sufficiency, that we could, if we worked on ourselves hard enough, really stand on our own and make a difference. And churches then, as Anthony Robinson writes, said the pastor could preach a left-of-center political sermon, and that the world's renovation and change was within our own hands, and which, with sufficient resolve, we could make things better. And that just writing letters to politicians is all that it would take to change the way government did things. So if you had then a strong preacher, if you had people inviting others to worship all the time, and if you had the preacher always reminding people to give more money, then the church would work. And that virtuous cycle, it did work. And it worked, and it caused the church to thrive in amazing ways. But that virtuous cycle has been interrupted. It has been interrupted because we have become aware of the brokenness that exists within people. We have become aware that not everything a person does is honorable and intended for the best. I was speaking with a colleague who said in a forum that we were in, who said, we are living in dark times. And I love having people in my life that allow room for pushback and engagement. And I ask him this question, is it that we are living in dark times? Or is it that what has been done in the shadows has finally come to light? That what has been done in the shadows has finally come to light. And I think that's exactly where we find ourselves. We have a clear picture of what happens in the shadows. And in the shadows, we see racist hearts. And in the shadows, we see sexist hearts. And in the shadows, we see white male fragility. A colleague of mine from Lancaster Brethren in Christ Church said that white males right now are sort of like standing on this glass floor. And as they continue to get challenged with the issue of race and lifting up and empowering women, that glass floor is starting to crack and they're afraid they're going to fall down through. Which leads many to the desire to destroy those of other races and other sexes. What has been in the shadows has come the light. And so it interrupts that virtuous cycle because we become aware of what is broken. And it interrupts this virtuous cycle that we have as a congregation because the way that the church used to work doesn't work anymore, but it's no one's fault. It's a change in culture into which we must all move and adjust. What does Paul say to Timothy and his congregation? You know, why is it you are spending so much time haggling over words and blame? Realize what's going on and be ready to make that change. So a couple decades ago, there was a movie that came out called Field of Dreams with Kevin Costner. And the most famous line from that movie is, if you build it, they will come. But the fact that you all can say that shows how much that line has had an impact. And you need to realize that that line from that movie became a theological statement in churches for what they should do next with their ministry. That if you build it, they will come. And so churches have expanded their facilities in enormous ways. And most of them now are trying to figure out how to pay off millions of dollars of debt when it's already done and the people aren't fired up about the project anymore. We flirted with that notion here at Holy Trinity. Radically expand our facility because if you build it, they will come. And it's rooted on a model that if you just provide the space, the church will grow. And that's the old virtuous cycle at play. It's a cycle that will not work for us anymore. And what I'm proposing to you is a new model that says, if you help people grow, they will fill the space. If you allow people to grow, they will fill the space. And it's a call for us to look at how we are shaping this community in a way that allows people to grow. Because what we want as people to grow is that we want people to demonstrate maturity. A congregation that demonstrates maturity is a congregation that will grow. And maturity, in part, is not jumping off the cliff every time you feel bad about something or worry about something, but is thinking and processing something. And we know as Christians that there are things coming at us from the rest of the world that we don't understand and we can't figure out how to process yet. One of those came in an email to Pastor Tasha and me this week. It is a local not-for-profit who is reaching out to churches and asking that we ask women in our congregation to consider becoming surrogate mothers. I have to admit that in 22 years of ministry, I've never encountered that request before. They did promise that it pays well. And so if you're interested, let me know. So now I can say that I brought it up to the congregation. But I'm working on that because I know how I feel about it. But it's not how I feel about it. It's how I think about it theologically and morally and ethically. That is what is to shape my next step with it. That's maturity. Taking time to own the feelings, but move to that which is thinking and using that God-given rational part of our brains. A church that wants people to grow is a church that honors the integrity of other people, that every single person has an integrity, has a sense of being and who they are that should not be violated by anyone else. And that person's integrity should not be violated because they're a male or a female. That person's integrity should not be violated because they are of a different race. That person's integrity should not be violated because they're of a different culture or economic level. That person's integrity should never be violated because they are a created child of God. And we honor their integrity. And we are aware that the greatest violation of human integrity is the pattern of using words to diminish other people. A community that wants people to grow, a community that wants to grow, is a community that allows room for creativity. That wonderful spark that's in people that looks at new ideas and new ways of engaging with one another. Imagine what would have happened if Ohio State, when they hired Urban Meyer as their head coach, and I'm a happy guy because all three of my football teams won yesterday. Penn State won, Ohio State won, and Duke won yesterday. So it would have been a very different sermon. They would have lost yesterday. But Urban Meyer, who I think is one of the best college coaches right now, what would have happened if Ohio State had hired him, celebrated his ability, and then said to him, now, these are the only plays that you are allowed to use? How successful would he have been in his work? Would have been no success at all. But to see the ability he has and set him free to use that ability in ways that allow him and those around him to excel. The church that wants to grow is the church that wants people to grow and that allows room for creativity. And the church that wants to grow, the church that wants people to grow, is the church that's about anti-fragility. That is, there's a resilience among people. And that resilience is a resilience that allows people to hear the truth when it's spoken to them in love. And we have the capacity to speak the truth in love, but we are also called to hear the truth in love. And when there are things that we are doing or saying that are harmful to others, we need to be willing to hear that, the truth spoken in love. when people are allowed to grow, the community will grow and fill the space. And that growth is a growth in maturity and integrity and creativity and in resilience. And it sets people free, which is resurrection power. Being set free. So just like my family has lived in three different houses, my son has had now three different beds in his 13 years of life. There was the crib, and then there was a small twin bed, and now there is this double bed that he has, which we got him because he had outgrown the twin bed. But now what I encounter in the mornings when I go up to say good morning to him and to wake him up is that I get up there and his feet are hanging over the edge of the end of the bed. Now, he just turned 13, he's 5'11 already, so it's going to be an ongoing problem. And there are times when I think, oh great, we'll have to get him a new bed, and I thought, you know what, if he would just scoot himself up and get his head closer to the headboard, he would fit in that bed for a little longer. And there are times when he's so far down in the bed and the way the bed sits in the room that I can't open the door to his bedroom because the door hits his feet as they're hanging off the end of the bed. Isn't that funny? When someone starts to grow, we want to tell them to change and stop. It is about me continuing to provide for my son what he needs to grow and flourish. And I want that for him because I love him and I desire what is best for him. And that's what Christian community can do when it's at its most faithful and best, is help people grow. For in that growth, then the community will grow. Amen.